This week, the NASDAQ continued its heavenly ascent on course to overtake even the dot-com peak. Welcome, everyone. Your host, Chris Waltzek, back with you on this special Memorial Day holiday where we here in the U.S. remember our fallen heroes and heroines who gave their lives protecting our nation. Most of us know someone who either served or lost someone who did serve our country. We hope that you'll reach out and just let them know how much their memory and sacrifice means to you. You know, a cup of coffee or even a lunch, dinner, it's a small price to pay for the freedoms we've been extended. So what's on the docket this weekend? Well, you guessed it, two more must-hear guest interviews. Many of our listeners will enjoy this week's show, maybe even more than usual. My guests have a wide spectrum of opinions. Makes for a lively dialogue. Fabian Calvo from the NoteHouse.us manages millions of dollars in distressed real estate. He's watching the equities market margin levels with a weary eye. Each time the crash harbinger reached overextended points in the past, well, a recession followed and a stock market decline. He's also concerned that many of the jobs that we have today will be replaced by automation in the next decade, resulting in an Arnold Terminator movie-like scenario, catching most of us off guard. Then Arch Crawford returns to the show. He elucidates listeners with his comments on the FOMC rate hike expected later in the year, and he doesn't think there's much of a chance that one can even come to pass because things just aren't as rosy as our officials would like us to think. It might even create an economic landslide, and we'd like to record your questions and comments. You can call in 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. Be sure and leave your first name or just stay anonymous if you'd like. The Q&A hotline, 1-206-666-5370. And you'll want to stay tuned for Robert Ian's must-hear editorial wrapping up this week's show. GoldSeek.com radio begins now with a market weather recap. Well, at Friday's closing bell on the New York COMEX exchange, gold was only off about $19 at $12.04. Silver gave back less than 50 cents, ending above $17. And the XAU and gold and silver equities index was off about 4 points, around 71.25, about 5%. West Texas Intermediate crude lost a fractional amount, only 25 cents, ending near the $60 benchmark. And moving the markets this week, the Fed Chair Janet Yellen gave a speech on the economic outlook in Providence, Rhode Island. Dr. Yellen noted that she expects the Fed to finally start raising rates this year. If the economy continues to improve as she expects, she said, she anticipates the pace of normalization will be gradual, and to decipher that Fed speak, they will raise rates gradually over many years. She noted that the Fed will tighten more quickly, though, if conditions were to suddenly crater. Given that the jobless rate recently fell to 5.4%, the best since the last recession, it would seem that officials have that wiggle room. Nevertheless, underemployment remains stubbornly high at about 11%. The chair did caution that rate hikes could take place over several years. And the next Federal Open Market Committee meeting is slated for June 16th, 17th. In addition, the April minutes of the FOMC meeting were released, and only a few of the Fed officials thought economic data would improve enough to trigger a rate hike at the next meeting in June. So, pretty much as we've been anticipating here for several months, a September-December rate hike seems likely. Moving on, an interesting article from Bloomberg News this week showed that if China moves to the gold standard, as many of our guests are expecting, the price of bullion will soar as high as $64,000 an ounce. That's 50 times the current level. The idea is simple. The country is attempting to make its yuan a reserve currency, and of course, accumulating gold is one of the best ways to increase global confidence and capital flows into your nation. Precious metals, bottom line. Well, the dollar rallied sharply on Dr. Yellen's comments, indicating that a rate hike is virtually a lock this year. I think a longer-term perspective on the precious metals is required here because the greenback remains strong, and as long as that's the case, it'll put some pressure on the sector. Mostly cloudy weather appeared over the New York Stock Exchange on Friday. The Dow Jones Industrials ended at 18,232, only off 41 points. The S&P 500 ended at 2126, off just 3 points fractionally. And the NASDAQ bucked the trend once again, adding 41 points, 1.3%, near a 15-year closing weekly high at 5089. Benefiting clearly from the strong dollar as money flowed away from the blue chips, favoring instead the tech stocks as dollar strength decreases the multinationals' profit margin. Meanwhile, positive news this week included Deere and Company shares, which flew higher by almost 5% after the farm equipment producer reported better-than-expected profits. Campbell Soup also reported its profits topped expectations in the latest reading. Shares flew higher over 2%. Bottom line on Wall Street. Well, our 7 indicator sentiment index is still in the greedy category. Not a really positive sign given the volatility we're starting to see in the markets. And the stock market will be closed in observation of Memorial Day on Monday. Coming up after the break, more GoldSeek.com radio. Stay with us right here. Well, my featured guest today, Arch Crawford, uses all types of technical analysis combined with his own proprietary work. Hello, sir.
Delighted to be here. Thank you.
How is the weather today in that part of Arizona?
Well, this is a beautiful time of the year here. It's before the summer heat has set in. It's cool in the morning and pleasant in the afternoon. So we're enjoying it tremendously. We have citrus trees in the yard. Our cat chases hummingbirds around the yard.
We have a home up in the mountains, and with skylights in the ceiling, I had to rig up a special telescopic net in order to fishnet to rescue hummingbirds. Their favorite escape mechanism, as you probably know, is a vertical ascent. So they get trapped up in our skylights, and after 15, 20 minutes, you can imagine that type of hovering flight will exhaust all of their energy resources, and they collapse from a lack of energy.
Can you then pick them up and take them outside, or are they not easily accessible?
It would be too late by that point. When they exhaust their energy, we found they don't have enough energy to fly again and procure honey or nectar. So at that point, they expire. So what I do is I just take the net, capture them. They're pretty easy to, believe it or not, to capture once they're in a skylight. It's about 20 feet up, and then just release them outside. And, you know, 9 out of 10 times, that seems to do the trick. But they're fascinating creatures. You know, they sit perfectly still, hovering. One of the few creatures in the world that can do that. So on to the markets. You know, we've had a lot of interesting activities, you know, in recent weeks, and I'm sure you've been watching the FOMC announcements. A lot of people waiting for the big rate hike. When will they, et cetera. It's looking like September, December. Does that seem to line up with your market outlook as well?
I don't trust what the FOMC is doing or say they're going to do. You know, they kept saying that they were going to raise rates, when every other country was lowering rates. And I said that I didn't think they would do it in the newsletter. And since then, they've gotten a lot worse fundamental economic information, and they're saying they won't raise rates unless the fundamental economic numbers get better, and they have not gotten better. So we've put it off from the potential of June to the potential of September by most analysts. I have other things happening in September that could interfere with anything and everything, major dislocations in the world generally, and in the United States in particular. In September.
Elucidate. Give us an idea of some of these things that you see on the horizon, please.
It's from everything from some of the cycles that I watch being really horrible at that time to Art Armstrong's pi cycle is occurring at that time. The end of the month of September is the end of the fiscal year for the United States. There are eclipses taking place and other astronomic phenomena that show great difficulty on the Earth. And, of course, we get Jade Helm 15 from June 15th to September 15th.
That's quite a fascinating exercise. They're calling it an exercise. Any type of organized military exercise that covers such a large area certainly should, I think, raise hairs and concerns, I think, by the typical American. Don't you agree?
They should wake up and be very aware. The governor of Texas has activated the National Guard to watch them. It's all he said so far.
Sometimes I worry that by having an open mind, you have a tendency to be labeled with very unsavory monikers.
I'm aware.
I thought that you might be. And the sad thing about that is there's such a stigma attached with not having it. And it dawned on me, I'm very pro-military in the terms of militia, meaning state militias, protecting our borders, which is what I thought our military's original purpose was intended to be.
Amen, but I read that book too.
Well, you know, we've had John Perkins on the show for many years. Now, Confessions of an Economic Hitman is a must read. And I'd love to talk about Jade Helm and the implications and what you really think is going on behind the scenes. But I think we better stick with the market. Let's focus now like a laser back on what you see happening here with the financial markets.
Well, for instance, we've just made new highs in the S&P and the Dow Jones for the first time. It's on the lowest volume since December. Lowest volume of this year. It makes a new high. This is unprecedented that they keep making new highs on decreasing volume and momentum. So I think it's being totally rigged, and maybe they'll jam it up until the Jade Helm takes over.
Your forecasts coincide, as you mentioned, with Martin Armstrong's pi model, which is interesting. You know, I've tinkered around with it a bit. I've backed out the equation a couple of times and then applied it to several different markets. There seems to be some cyclicality at work. But what I find interesting is the, the Hebrew Shemata. At first, I just thought, well, is this just more religious hocus pocus? Started to delve into the numbers, and I noticed, now, we go back to 1987. Well, we all remember the 25% haircut the S&P took in the fall of 1987. I mean, I remember it. I was 18 years old at the time. Then in 1994, hey, interesting coincidence, 7 years later, we had a nice little crisis. Again in 2001, everyone remembers 9/11 and the way the markets, underperformed.
We had the worst down week since the fall of France in May of 1940, the week after 9/11.
Exactly, yeah. And then let's fast forward another 7 years. 2008. That literally marks the end of the financial system. It's just on life support and has remained on life support, according to the Fed's balance sheet numbers, doubling every 24 months since 2008 without fail, and it appears ready to blast higher again. We fast forward from 2008. Well, coincidence, maybe, but that's 2015, and we're coming up at the end of 2015 in a few months. That cycle right there, which some people claim is a rhythm that is religious in nature, and others say that it's just an important cycle.
It's a lunar cycle that the Israelis are on the lunar cycle, as are the Arabs, but the Arabs have a different end date, and that changes more frequently. But the Jewish state is on the lunar calendar, and it's the 29th day of Elul is the day of the end of the Shemitah, or the beginning of the Shemitah.
And of course, for those who don't know or are unaware, as I understand the Shemitah, as you're pronouncing it, it's almost like a jubilee. It's a time where debts are to be forgiven. Tends to, for some reason, whether it's coincidence or if it's by design, I guess we'll probably never know, seems to be a period of instability in the financial markets. I just find it fascinating that we're finally coming up on this cycle, and that doesn't mean we're going to see something in the fall. You know, a lot of times these events occur 6 months in either direction. The other thing to keep in mind is markets tend to be discounting, aren't they, Arch? You know, they can discount up to 6 months in advance or more.
Well, I have that whole story about the Shemitah and I have a link to Rabbi Kahn's YouTube that has seen over 500,000 views on my website. And I'm talking about other people who are also predicting big things for September. And I have a link to Martin Armstrong's article about it and a link to some other people's articles about it. Also about the blood moons and all of that. A link to the one on Wikipedia and other things. But I am concerned about those time frames. If you remember, you don't remember, in 1987, I predicted the top day because it was a five-body conjunction, the tightest in at least 800 years that I checked. And it was supposed to be the harmonic convergence, but the people who were celebrating the harmonic convergence had were a week early before that concentration of planetary energy, and I had predicted 3 weeks ahead of time the top day exactly. That was the high close in the Dow, was August 24th, 1987, and I said after that there will be a horrendous crash, and so I made my name in Wall Street, although my market letter had been going 10 years. I really made all the big names all of a sudden rushed to take my newsletter as the market was crashing, or the week or two, a month or two after.
Well, you know, hat tip for that call, but I think now you'd probably agree that just as we're seeing greater strength on the upside, we'll likely see a bigger splash on the downside. And I don't see how anyone could argue against the fact that this is directly correlated with massive leverage. I mean, we're talking in 1987, you were probably hard pressed to do much better than 2-1, 5-1, 10-1. Today, institutions are regularly employing 50 and 100-1 or more. What you can do is use a margin account with an instrument like, let's say, a futures contract. And then if you've already borrowed in a highly leveraged manner to procure the funds that are in that account, you don't even have to be an institution to lever yourself 50 or 100-1.
You can buy an option on the future. Don't recommend it for innocent folk.
Exactly. So, you know, and then, you know, when this ship turns around, you know, there are going to be plenty of professionals all vying to become the next Jesse Livermore, the big plunger on the downside. There's going to be vast fortunes made by very few people on the way up, and there will be even larger fortunes made in a very brief period of time on the way down. And I think the key here is that the everyday homme moyen really must protect themselves against the volatility that all of this leverage is going to bring. And that's why we have folks like you on the show.
Well, thank you. One of the things that I do recommend, I almost never recommend options trading for clients, at least certainly not non-professional clients. But I do keep for myself a few put options, a small amount, like $500, $700, $1,000 worth a month, just in case these things occur surprisingly overnight, where the gold could go up hundreds of dollars and the stock market could go down thousands of points.
If you've read Black Swan by Nassim Taleb, Taleb's personal investing strategy, which incidentally he employed briefly for about a year and a half with a hedge fund that was wildly successful, it sounds remarkably similar to what you've outlined here. He believed that you should tie up 90% of your wealth at any given time in 100% cash, which to him was really like short-term T-bonds. I don't really consider that cash. But his idea was it needs to be just as safe as money in the bank, or even safer. And then you speculate, as I'm sure you know, with the remaining 10%, taking outliers, either end of the bell curve, if you will, more not like a bell curve, but more like a leptocurtic model, like Pareto's curve, for instance. So out on either end of the bell curve in the fat tails, as he refers to them, and that's where you get the most bang for your buck with a tiny amount of money. And then if one of these bets pays off, it pays off 1,000-1 or 100-1, and your other 90% is just sitting there safe.
Well, in 2008, I put $2,500 into these very fairly short-term and out-of-the-money puts and took out $500,000 on November the 20th, which would have been my mother's 100th birthday, so I think she had something to do with it from the others.
What I wanted to get to here was you're talking about, you know, out of the money calls and puts, if you will. And of course, these are remarkably inexpensive. I mean, you might pay, let's say, 10 cents for a put. 10 cents on $100 is $10. So you might pay more on the commission to buy the put than the put itself. But I would say that for most people, wouldn't you liken it to gambling? It would have to be money that's viewed as speculative and not investment grade, right?
It's insurance. How much do you pay for your insurance? You don't get any money back on that. You hope you never have to use it.
But wouldn't you prefer to wait for the trend to change and then start to speculate? Or is it that you like the low premiums due to the fact that the market is going contrary in the contrary direction? Do you follow the Greeks at all? Do you look at the deltas and the alphas and all the rest?
It is a thing that you should know about if you're going to do anything with options.
You know, I used to like the idea of a delta neutral strategy, but in reality, there really is no such. You have to adjust the account constantly to maintain a delta neutral. You have much more than just systemic risk. You have the problem of market risk, which can shift anywhere from the currency market nowadays to the derivatives market to the real estate market to bonds and stocks and whatnot. And that brings up another idea. I think we've harped on this long enough. I'd like to shift over to the bond market. I've had guests on here lately, Arch, who are convinced this is the bubble. It's the unknown. Only the insiders are talking about it, that there is a 30-year systemic bond market bubble that no one's looking at, no one knows about. Maybe only the insiders are aware of. They're doing everything they can to keep it afloat, but it could go down. And when it does, it takes everything with it. Any thoughts there?
A month ago, one of the things, four charts I have on page two of the newsletter is the 30-year bond. And I have it on a monthly chart. It's a very regular ascending movement from lower left to upper right. Then it extended itself a year or so ago and made a somewhat higher channel. Recently, it spiked well above that channel and has pulled back right down to the top of that, the first channel, which means to me it was an extreme spike and it may have put in the top. And I said so in the letter last month or the month before that. I don't remember when exactly I put that out. But I certainly agree that there's grave danger. Now, there's also grave danger of the opposite, in which case the government allows the feds and the banks to go to negative interest rates or do something what they did in Cyprus, where they just took the money, period. I'm afraid of that.
There was an article this morning making the internet blogosphere rounds, alluding to just that thought. Or will the Greeks wake up to a similar Cyprus moment where they go to sleep and they have $500,000 in their savings account and they wake up and it's $250,000? Or, you know, will anything under or over a certain amount suddenly be confiscated? This whole concept of rehypothecation is something where people think they're safe because they don't have a margin account, but the fine print is something that requires a microscope nowadays to decipher. And I've actually listened to lawyers and counselors say that even some of their colleagues can't decipher or make heads or tails. Partners in law firms who have difficulty understanding just what's hidden between the lines.
I believe they make it vague, so then they can have some paid off judge take their side of it in a lawsuit.
I've been studying recently, just out of curiosity, the first true forensic toxicologist in New York City. And his name was Gettner, and he grew up during a time, you know, his family came from the old world. It was a really difficult time, and he worked his way through school and got together with this brilliant prosecutor named Norris. And they decided, we're going to shake the tree. We're going to get all this rottenness and corruption out of the system, and we're going to make toxicology and forensic a true science. And as a result, they standardized everything. They saved people from going to the electric chair. actually had court cases overruled simply by exhuming corpses, studying the contents of their stomachs, the linings of the stomach, and things of that nature, finding cyanide, arsenic, and things of this nature. And it's just a heroic thing. And the reason I mention that is that I suspect we need something like that in the financial system. The corruption is so rife that people have to take steps to protect themselves.
In the very short term now, we have a sharp move up in the dollar index against a very steep downtrend. It just broke out on the upside this morning. And inversely, the oil and the gold have broken down. The gold is down $20 today, which is fairly unusual. Every day and then it has a $20 move, very rarely more than that. But 20 is common, maybe, you know, once every month or 2 months, down 20 today while the dollar is up. The new highs in the markets on decreasing volume and momentum, just they don't make any sense unless the whole thing is like rigged.
Well, I think there's a lot going on there, Arch, and I think an aspect of it is contrived. I mean, there are machinations. I mean, certainly let's say 30 to 50% of that. I've talked to guests in the past who agree that much of the bailout funds have just been directed by the major corporations into repurchasing their shares in treasury stock and things of that nature. But there's also the aspect of money fleeing, I'm sure you'd agree, from the Eurozone due to the Grexit and potential Greek drama we have there. So you see a lot of money fleeing that part of the world, but you also see money, a huge amount of capital flowing from China. They're cash rich, they have too many dollars, and they can reinvest it back in the United States as well as in the Shanghai Exchange, which I'm sure you've seen at least in recent weeks, not last week, but recently blasting to new highs as well. So there's really a lot of irons in the fire, aren't there?
Yes, and one of the big things that have happened this year is all of the major rapid shifts in different markets where the Swiss unhooked the euro and the euro dropped 30% in 15 minutes and closed down 18% on the day. These are huge numbers in terms of the margins required to trade them. And then we had the oil come down and the interest rates and the bonds came down. What was it? In the past 2 weeks, huge moves relative to the amount of margin required because they don't make those kinds of moves. So,
yeah, wouldn't you agree, though, that the 30-year looks like it's approaching a pretty solid accumulation bottom here? Short-term, look, the 1 to 5 year T-bill looks like it wants to fly higher, and I have a feeling probably look for a short-term trade on a bottom in the 30-year bond, don't you think?
Well, it pulled back down and it stopped on the top of its previous trend channel line. So there is support there. If it breaks that, it's going down a lot more. If it holds there, it could have another rise. And if one thing about the Fed is they're loaded up with bonds still, and they may know something we don't in that the bonds are going much higher, which doesn't make sense, but it's happening in Europe where they go into negative interest rates.
I was just going to say, you may have alluded to it. Maybe the Fed does a token rate hike just to, save face, if you will. And then before you know it, we do start to see negative rates across the board just to get competitive. It's one possibility, but I fear that if they do something like that, it's really the final step to hyperinflation. I mean, they're printing so much now. I can't find a time in history where that didn't lead to runaway inflation eventually. And most of my more senior guests point out, yes, but you're forgetting the bond market eats up all that inflation. It absorbs all of it. But how long can that sponge absorb this endless money? Eventually, it has to be wrung of the inflation.
Well, what I'm concerned about in this case is that normally, okay, they break trend lines this way and that way, and give you some warning. And I'm afraid this time it's going to be an overnight situation where the whole thing takes place. Boom, we wake up and our fortunes are gone and we don't have any clue to what happened.
And I think there's some precedent here. This is not just pie-in-the-sky speculation on your part. For instance, as we just alluded to, the Cyprus event, people wake up and anything over a certain amount, goodbye. You didn't have time to thumb through 1,400 pages of documents. That's just one component here. The other component is, of course, the lightning speed of the digital world. And then there's the lack of backing of our global financial system. You could make the case, it's arguable, that it is not a matter of if, it's simply a matter of when.
I'm in 100% agreement with you there. I recommend that people go to my website, www.crawfordperspectives.com, and look at some of the links about things coming up in September. Very briefly, we predicted in the newsletter when the progressed Mars went retrograde in the United States chart in 2006, that I said it will be retrograde for 72 years, and at the end of that period, we'll be like a third world country.
Do you have a timeline? I mean, a more specific timeline for something like this?
Well, I didn't think it would happen this fast. I thought it would have happened in 72 years, and in 8 years, we've almost done it.
While the government statistics show, the lowest unemployment rate in something like 7 or 8 years, inflation completely tame, where is the inflation? We can't find it. Your manservants and your maids do your shopping for you? Because the last time I was at the The point is, I think you're right. We are nearing third world status, but the collusion and the cover-up is remarkable. The middle class, which used to be the foundation and the backbone of this country, as you know, have been eviscerated. I mean, now that's a cliche. There's a brilliant new documentary that just came out free for Prime members of Amazon.com last night that shows 100,000 people living homeless in Los Angeles. That's 100,000 known people. What you're missing in that statistic are the other 900,000 who are living in their cars and don't show up in the statistic. We're talking about millions of school children actually in our schools living under bridges, living in cardboard boxes, living in temporary shelters and hotel rooms with 5 or 6 of their siblings, cousins, aunts, uncles, and parents going on in this country today. All the while, we're hearing about the economic miracle that we're all enjoying. Yeah, I better get off my podium here. I didn't mean to give some draconian lecture. I know our listeners are going to enjoy all of your commentary today and the, witty repartee. Arch, please tell folks more about the service you provide as well as how folks can reach you.
Okay, we've had Crawford Perspectives newsletter 38 years this coming Sunday. We have kept in one of the best records in written history, which was alluded to by Robert Prechter on an interview in London. They asked him at the end of the interval, well, who's been good in this business? And Prechter said, well, Arch Crawford probably has the best 30-year record. And if you look at the Holbert rankings and whatnot, much of my 10 calls were not included in his record, including the crash in 87, so that whatever good record I've had with him, and it's not as stellar as if he would have counted a longer period of my time. But the website is CrawfordPerspectives.com. The phone number is 520-577-1158. The email is CrawfordPerspectives@earthlink.net. It's easier to Google my name, Arch Crawford, and then find the website than it is to write in Crawford Perspectives.
You know, the Elliott Way Forecasting Center is just down the road here, not even probably an hour away from our studio office with, the Elliott Wave folks and Mr. Prechter, who if he mentioned that, and I'm sure he did, that's certainly high praise coming from someone who's considered one of the best forecasters in the world. So folks are going to need to get your browsers directed over to Arch's website, please. Arch Crawford, we're going to look forward to having you back on the show.
Thank you so much.
Here is your mining quiz for the day, compliments of Gold Seek. Which company has the largest undeveloped gold reserve in North America?
Seabridge Gold.
Now, which company has the largest undeveloped copper reserve in North America?
Seabridge Gold again.
Seabridge has more gold reserves than Kinross, Yamana, and Agnico Eagle. Last year alone, Seabridge added 515 million tons of new inferred resources containing nearly 6 million ounces of gold and more than 6 billion pounds of copper at their giant KSM project in British Columbia, Canada. Now they are drilling at KSM again with multiple rigs in a 25,000-meter program. Find out more by visiting www.seabridgegold.net. Traded on the NYSE, symbol SA, and the TSX, symbol SEA.
GoldSeek employees may or may not own shares. Nothing contained herein should be construed as investment advice.
It's a pleasure to have Fabian Calvo back on the show. He runs the notehouse.us. Welcome, Fabian Calvo.
Chris, thanks for having me on. I appreciate it.
Start off today, if we could, with the New York Stock Exchange margin dip. Currently, margin levels are at all-time record highs right along with the Dow Jones and the S&P 500. And our listeners will have a chance to look at this chart as well as they download this show later. This looks like a leading indicator. You tend to see some disparity between the stock market and the margin debt, and then it really tails off in craters. And this happened in the last two market zeniths just before the recession. Tell us more about this and what you're watching, please.
It's one of the reasons, what you just laid out, is one of the reasons why we're seeing yet again today the Dow Jones hit a record high. And it's not just the margin debt that's out of control, but it's also these central banks that have pumped in tens of trillions of dollars into global equities. So it's a major, major bubble. And they're inflating these bubbles across the board. I mean, everywhere from the fine art market to the real estate market to the stock market. Certainly the margin debt, you know, as you mentioned, Chris, is a really good indicator for coming busts. However, I think, you know, this time around, there's so many other complexities where we're just not talking about margin debt as it relates to the Dow Jones. We're talking about the multi-bubble U.S. economy across the spectrum. We're talking about major debt levels that have been unprecedented compared to GDP in history. And so there's so many things that I think, you know, it's why I talk about this real economic shift or global economic shift that I think we're on the cusp of.
There really are a lot of cross currents, aren't there? And I'm glad you brought that up. You know, you can't just put your finger like maybe we could in the past 20, 30 years ago and say, oh, well, you know, it's a stock market problem or a bond market issue or, you know, inflation is runaway. No, we've got such a globally connected, interconnected market here around the world with just central bankers out of control, money printing, rehypothecation, you know, Grexit, Cyprus-like event any day, people getting really nervous around the world. And maybe that's a good segue then into the Greek drama. You've been watching this closely. We could see another Cyprus-like event at any moment here, maybe even worse. Tell us what you think about the situation developing there.
I think it's a perfect kind of microcosm, if you will, of what happens when you have, in essence, reckless entitlement social programs that are not being funded and you're borrowing more money to continue to fuel that type of recklessness. Now, that said, of course, when you have, you know, Goldman Sachs and J.P. Morgan go into Greece, cook their financial books in order to be able to give them even more loans, and in essence, you know, use the Greek islands and use their shipping and use their mining as collateral, or even, you know, some of their archaeological sites, which apparently now are being sold or are being leased out to bankers to have parties. You're going to have a serious problem on your hands. Now, with Greece, though, I'd say, Chris, that they stay in the euro. And the only reason I think that is when you look at what happened in Greece, pretty much the same thing happened in Portugal, Ireland, Spain, Italy, where these countries, you know, were in essence railroaded. Not that they weren't running, you know, not that they had terrible social and political programs in place, but there was a lot of fraud, I believe, in a lot of that debt. So if Greece goes out of the euro, you know, the bankers potentially have a risk of having this exposed, this big scheme exposed of how they, in essence, indebt these countries in order to be able to reap the collateral that these countries have. It's really, you know, it's talked about in the great book, Confessions of an Economic Hitman, which I'm sure many in the audience have read.
No, we've had John Perkins on the show in the past. It's been a few years. Fantastic guest, and he lays it all out there and outlines it. And I think you make another really important point. You talk about this scheme, this banker trap, if you will, or maybe net that's kind of slowly coming up around all of us, and in particular there in Southern Europe. And what I find so ironic is the Greek drachma. Very few people talk about the 700-year history of this silver-backed currency that was really the hallmark of currencies, or the envy of many countries around the world. They had this solid, stable economy. They weren't dependent on their northern neighbors and whatnot, a feat of financial engineering, and they've lost that. And there's no talk about it other than from Hugo Salinas Price, you know, the self-made billionaire in Mexico, who suggested you guys need to return to a silver-based currency. That's what led to your great success in the first place.
I agree 100%. It's actually a really good point. You're right. It's not talked about enough. And I've been saying now for some time, Chris, that I think Greece would be way better off if they did get out of the euro, if they did go back to a currency that was backed by some type of commodity, in this case, silver, and if they rebuilt their economy around their tourism, mining, and shipping that they have an abundance of. Does that mean it's going to be an easy road? Of course not. Anytime, I mean, it's like, you know, if right now you had someone, you know, the new president say, hey, listen, we are in dire straits financially. Here's what we need to do. We need to go back to a gold-backed currency. We need to raise interest rates. We need to, you know, begin to have austerity. That's going to inflict major pain. But the pain that will come from not doing any of those things is typically revolution, economic collapse, social chaos. Certainly that's a potential for Greece. But it's really unfortunate because, you and I can sit here, Chris, and the audience can, you know, listen in. And I think a lot of us would agree that makes sense. You know, go through the pain, but let's rebuild. It certainly hasn't been playing out like that, not just with Greece, but with the U.S. and with most of the West.
Price says, take 10% of your gold stockpile, and instead of enriching your northern neighbors, all of these debtors and creditors, you could then simply buy up a big stockpile of silver and make sure that every household has that safety net in place, and that will cushion some of that pain that you're talking about in the short term, and also help offset the inevitable day of reckoning. It's going to come if they don't take some kind of steps eventually anyway. So it's a great point, but let's shift gears back here to the United States. You know, you bring up, I think, some points in recent videos, and you talk about the job paradigm. I'm going to let you run with the ball here. What an interesting topic. 93 million Americans officially no longer in the job force. That's about one in three people. You say this is due to a changing workplace, and most of us have our heads stuck in the collective sand. Help prepare our listeners today.
Well, certainly, it is the end of the job paradigm. I mean, you know, everyone's heard the analogy, you go to school, you go to college, get a good job, and that used to work. That used to work out in the United States. It used to work out in most of the industrialized world. It's not working out anymore, though. Even the ones that do go to college and walk away with hundreds of thousands of dollars in debt, they can't repay back their loans, or if they can, you're lucky to get a job at Starbucks. In fact, there's a Starbucks coffee not far from where I live, Chris, and I promise you, everyone that works there has graduated from a college, because I talked to them. It's graduated from a pretty decent college, and they're working at Starbucks. So, you know, when you factor in automation, when you factor in globalization, when you factor in the rise of the robots, when you factor in applications and smartphones and all the new technology, you're talking about millions upon millions of jobs that will never come back. What it means is that they have to change and adapt. Personally, I believe that there is, you know, that we are living in the golden age of business, which, you know, is maybe runs counter to the first 10 minutes of talking about, you know, the global economic reset and all this other problems that we see. But in spite of that, we live in a world today where anyone can start a business on the internet with really no money. I mean, you know, some money, but think about it. 10 years ago, you wanted to start a new business. You needed to get a lease. You maybe needed to get a loan from the bank. You don't need to do that. So the barrier, you know, has really been broken. Unfortunately, there's not enough people taking advantage of it, maybe because just out of ignorance, they just may not know about it. But that's where I think the new opportunity lies. Let me give you another real quick one, too. Gold Seek Radio. you know, you have this passion, you have this show, you have, you know, hundreds of thousands of people that download your podcasts. You know, it's like you have to be able to, in this age, you have to be able to create your own job. And what I found is when you create your own job based around what you love to do, it's the way to go.
But I also wanted to direct our listeners back onto this job paradigm that you referred to, that up to half of the current jobs could evaporate over the next decade or so. And then most of the jobs that we will be offered in the future don't even exist now. Now, that's a sea change. That is something that's going to catch everyone off like a boomerang out of left field. Tell us a little bit more about what's going on there.
I'm glad you brought that up. And you know, Chris, I'm 36 years old. I look at the world, how it's changed just since my 20s. And it's incredible, really. I mean, what's the next 10 years going to look like? So, yes, of course, we're not going to know what most of the jobs that are out there are going to, because we don't know what technology is going to be like. We don't know. And, you know, look, there's people that will listen to this and say, well, no. The economic collapse is going to be so bad. It's going to be the dark ages for the next 500 years. You know, I personally disagree with that. Of course, anything's possible. I'll just say that the only thing that we can expect when it comes to the job market is it's rapidly evolving and changing. And unless people aren't rapidly evolving and changing, and unfortunately, for people that are in their 60s and 70s, or, you know, they may be retired, but let's say late 50s, early 60s, you know, it becomes a little bit harder to evolve and change.
And we're all going to have to see how we can most efficiently and effectively prepare ourselves to create the value that you talk about so regularly.
I think people need to be really careful, because as things deteriorate with the economy, the statists will use that deterioration to pass more draconian legislation that will only make things worse. And the example of that is the $15 an hour minimum wage that they implemented in places like Seattle and some other places, where restaurants are closing down left and right because the business owners cannot afford it. What's most interesting is that you have these people that are demanding $15 an hour for the, you know, to make French fries. In 2 years, the French fry machine is going to take their job. And of course, you know, the politicians know this, and the unions that represent these people know this. They don't care, though. And it's really sad that, you know, there's a culture today of you need to be dependent on your job instead of, you know, what about being dependent on yourself, maybe a higher power to help you, you know, funnel? Because, you know, look, we all have, you know, whether you get them from God, whatever you believe in, we all have these unique gifts that are unique to us. I think we need to implement them and use them as a way, like you said, to add value. And to become self-reliant.
The takeaway point is to start preparing now, whether you're in your 30s, 40s, 50s, or even 60s. I mean, it's going to be a challenging environment. And my guess is you're going to tell everybody, hey, you need that entrepreneurial spirit.
You know, some people would chalk up, well, the people that had jobs in the Great Depression, or the people that still have jobs now, they're lucky. Or the entrepreneur that started his business and made it, he's lucky. Truth is that, you know, I personally don't believe in luck. I think luck is more of a factor of preparedness meeting opportunity, and that's something everyone can do. Look, we hear, and I'm sure, Chris, you hear this all the time as well. We hear, if you want to get prepared, go get, you know, food storage, guns and gold, and look, I believe in all that, and I've done all that. But at the end of the day, I need to be able to provide for my family and I. So what am I doing about that? I'm not somebody who believes, you know, I believe there will always be financial markets. There were financial markets in the dark ages. There were financial markets in the Great Depression. You know, what side do I want to be on? Do I want to be somebody who's trying to add value to the marketplace, even if times are hard? Or do I want to be somebody that's dependent on the state for my livelihood and the livelihood of my two young children? You know, it's pretty obvious which one I want. And I think most of the listeners would want that for themselves as well. I mean, look, you look at places, for example, like Venezuela or Cuba, where almost everybody, the doctor or an engineer, because it's free college, everybody can just go. Guess what? There's no job. You look at here in the States, and it's like, you know, and it seems like when I was in high school, there was vo-tech school. Now vo-tech, if you utter the name vo-tech, it's like a bad, you know, how dare you? Well, guess what? People need their refrigerators fixed, and that's a good job. And I'm so supportive of vocational schools. We need more of them. And you're right. Not everyone. And you know, I, in fact, like you said, I have several family members who are plumbers, fix appliances. They're doing really well. Business is doing great.
think it makes good sense. And not to mention, if you have a passion for a particular area, you can always self-educate or you can go online today. I mean, look at MIT, look at Yale, look at all of these great schools. Stanford and others are offering a tremendous amount of material from folks like Dr. Schiller of the Case Schiller Index. I mean, he has something like 100 hours of his best financial economic courses online. They're free of charge for anybody who's down at the library or has an iPhone. Alternatives, if you have a passion for learning that don't require, as you say, $100,000 in debt. Please tell folks more about the excellent services you provide and how people can get in touch with you if they'd like to.
Sure, yeah, they can see my YouTube videos at Fabian4Liberty. That's Fabian, the number 4, liberty.com. And for a lot of my entrepreneur seminars and things that I teach, they can always go to FabianCalvo.me. That's FabianCalvo.me.
Fabian Calvo, please return to Gold Seek Radio soon.
Absolutely. Chris, thanks for having me on. It's always a pleasure.
Here is your mining quiz for the day, compliments of Gold Seek. Which company has the largest undeveloped gold reserve in North America? Seabridge Gold. Now, which company has the largest undeveloped copper reserve in North America? Seabridge Gold again. Seabridge has more gold reserves than Kinross, Yamana, and Agnico Eagle. Last year alone, Seabridge added 515 million tons of new inferred resources containing nearly 6 million ounces of gold and more than 6 billion pounds of copper at their giant KSM project in British Columbia, Canada. Now they are drilling at KSM again with multiple rigs in a 25,000-meter program. Find out more by visiting www.seabridgegold.net. Traded on the NYSE, symbol SA, and the TSX, symbol SEA.
Gold Seek employees may or may not own shares. Nothing contained herein should be construed as investment advice.
Hey Chris, this is Robert Ian with ConquerChange.com. A Bloomberg article caught my attention this week whose headline read, Chinese gold standard would need a rate 50 times bullion's price. The article speculated that a move to a gold standard in China would require an exchange rate of $64,000 an ounce, which is roughly 50 times the current price of gold. The premise of the article states that a traditional gold standard, in which the precious metal backs the currency, is basically impossible at current prices due to the amount of metal that is needed. Let's stop right there. This premise, which is espoused by those who claim a gold standard will not work in today's financial system because there's just not enough of the metal to go around, fail to take into account the faulty nature of today's price discovery mechanism in the gold market. Indeed, the price of gold has risen in most currencies around the world, except the U.S. dollar. The fact is, there is plenty of gold to create a gold standard. It's not the volume of gold that needs to be increased to entertain a return to sound money currency. It's simply the price per ounce of the available gold, which is, was, and always will be finite. My friend Adrian Douglas, who passed away several years ago, wrote a blockbuster analysis of where he calculated the price of gold should have been in July of 2010. According to his calculations at that time, in an article I have referenced in previous commentaries called Proof of Gold Price Suppression, in July of 2010, he calculated the true price of gold at $54,000 an ounce and depicted it mathematically. with all the quantitative easing and debt expansion that has occurred since July of 2010, the current Bloomberg article that forecasts a needed $64,000 an ounce for a return to the gold standard is probably on the low side of the equation. The Bloomberg article speculated that any attempt to create a new gold standard would likely involve new technologies and depend on the ratio of what is backed. Bloomberg's research unit stated, Chinese policymakers are trying to establish the yuan as a reserve currency, and backing it with gold would help attract foreign capital inflows. They went on to state that, theoretically, to create an exchange rate of 1 ounce of gold for every $64,000, China would need about 10,000 metric tons of the metal, which is about 9 times the nation's official holdings and about 6% of all the bullion ever mined globally. Chinese policymakers have been pressing to add the yuan to the IMF's currency basket, known as special drawing rights, which includes the dollar, euro, yen, and British pound. Last month, the Bundesbank said the yuan needs to be seen as freely convertible before it can be considered as part of the special drawing rights basket. Much speculation abounds regarding how much gold China currently holds and how much gold they might potentially announce since their last official update several years ago. The number could be significant. And are we still to believe that the U.S. holdings of gold have not changed in decades from the acknowledged tradition, as Ben Bernanke framed it, of roughly 8,100 tons of gold? Well, time will tell. More gold isn't required for the initiation of a gold standard. What is required is the revaluation of the current gold price. That may be a planned event, or it may be a violent market-driven event. Somehow, some way, I believe that is the journey we are upon. Chris, I'd like to urge all of our listeners to sign up for my email list at conquerchange.com. And if any of our listeners are ever involved in bringing in keynote speakers for their companies or professional organizations, please visit my companion website at robertian.com. And until next time, this is Robert Ian with conquerchange.com. Reminding you to follow us on Twitter at Conquer Change. Thanks, Chris.